It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Today's podcast is an inspiring one. A few months ago, I came across a story about a music teacher in Tampa, Florida, who is living proof that if you really want to achieve something, with hard work and determination, it can be done. Matt Weimuller is a jazz instructor at the Patel Conservatory in Florida. He's had a love of music his whole life and cannot imagine his life without it. He loves passing on his passion to others, but it hasn't been an easy journey. Matt has been blind his whole life. His motto in life is turning a disadvantage into an advantage, and his story is incredible. After you hear this interview, you might just want to try something new or feel like you too can take on anything you put your mind to. You might also think about some of your favorite teachers or someone that had an impact on your life. I'm so grateful I had the chance to speak to Matt because I think his enthusiasm and determination rubbed off on me after our conversation. I hope you feel the same way. Here is Matt Weimuller on the Janice Dean podcast. Matt, thank you so much for being here. I saw your story and it was so inspiring. Both my children play cello and piano, so there's music in our house, and I know the significance of having music in our lives. So I thank you, first of all, for being here. And, you know, tell me when you started playing the saxophone.
I started when I was in middle school, so approximately around age 12. I started out actually on electric organ. My grandmother got an electric organ for one of the houses that she sold. She was a realtor, and I kind of messed around on that. And then a lot of my family members had played, you know, high school band, but had not taken it much further. And so I decided I'd try to follow in their footsteps, and it seems like a good activity. They put you through something called the wheel when you're, you know, that young, kind of exposing you to extracurricular activities. And the band seemed to really suit me. I was going to play trumpet actually, but the clarinet suited me much better. They kind of introduced you to one brass and woodwind instrument. The clarinet's a woodwind instrument. The trumpet's a brass instrument. And I liked the clarinet a lot. And then my band director in middle school was starting a jazz band, actually, which is kind of where we all begin on this journey. And I basically was recommended that I play saxophone. And he said, if you play saxophone, you get to be in my jazz band and have all these cool opportunities. And I was, you know, just kind of starting out. And I was like, oh, that sounds so cool. So I moved to the saxophone. And, you know, took lessons privately all the way through, and got into an honor band when I was, you know, in middle school, and met some people that were really talented that were just a little bit older than me. And they kind of encouraged me to keep playing. So I ended up going to a performing arts high school here in Tampa. It's called Howard W. Blake for the Arts. And got to end up playing with those older students. They were a couple of years older than me. One of them had it at his own album out actually already. So that was like really inspiring. And then I decided my senior year of high school that music is like air to me. I can't live without it. And just basically made a decision at that point, no matter what, I was going to do something with music. I wasn't certain at that time. I thought I might be more of a entertainment attorney. A lot of my family are lawyers. And so I thought, well, I'll kind of use this in conjunction with, you know, that profession. And then about sophomore year of college, I went to Florida State University and majored in music. And sophomore year, just kind of decided again, finally, I was like, well, this is really what I want to do. And so got my bachelor's degree at Florida State, and then went on and got my master's degree, and then moved back to Tampa, and was kind of trying to decide. Music is a very interesting thing, and I apologize, I'll stop in a second. I'm sure you have more questions. But music is kind of a career. It's not like some of the other careers where, you know, you go to law school and you get out and you try to be a part of a firm, or you're a doctor, you try to join a practice. You have to kind of create your own pathway in music. And I've tried to kind of use, you know, all of my different talents, and really decided I had a teacher in college named Marcus Roberts, who's visually impaired like myself, which I'll talk more about that in a second, being blind. But he taught me to really, you know, he used his disability as an inspiration to a lot of others. And he takes time. He's a touring jazz musician, very famous. And he takes time out of his year every year to teach students at the University of Florida State. And so, you know, I decided I wanted to follow in his footsteps, and that's kind of where I started teaching, and was lucky enough that there was a saxophone position at the Strass Center for the Performing Arts where I teach here in Tampa at the Patal Conservatory.
Mm. Well, you just summed up your journey pretty beautifully. You know, it strikes me, the teachers, you know, we always have one or two, if we're lucky, that inspire us. And you're so blessed to be able to, you know, go back in your mind and say, yes, that was the one that encouraged me and said that I can do this. And that's very clear in your mind that there were those people that inspired you and encouraged you.
Yes. Oh, definitely. There's been several, you know, from, like I said, that band director in middle school, you know, who kind of started me off, to the, you know, the students that were even just a little bit older than me. Something that I always try to encourage, even my current students right now that are a little bit more advanced, that you always want to find somebody that's, you know, kind of starting their journey, or maybe at a different level that, you know, that you may have some wisdom to impart on them, even if it doesn't, you know, seem like that. So I really encourage even my students who are like juniors and seniors in high school to try to start, you know, teaching maybe some of those beginning saxophone and musicians. You know, my private instructors have always been very encouraging, and I really find myself kind of going back to that now that I'm really doing what they were doing, and try to capitalize, you know, try to think about what are the things that they did to really motivate me and make me feel happy and good about the music, because that's really what music is about, is having fun and enjoying yourself and making the listener also, you know, feel good about themselves and really entertaining, you know, others as much as yourself, I think.
And we'll be back with more of the Janice Dean podcast right after this.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Tell me how you learned the music. I read that, you know, your mom helped you with creating Braille for the music you were playing.
Right. So it kind of, you have to go back a ways, all the way back to my beginning. So I was born with an eye disease called Leber's congenital amaurosis. Big, long word. I won't try to spell it at the moment, but it basically has to do, you know, basically the connection from my eyeballs to my brain are almost non-existent. So I can see only light and dark. If there's sun shining through like a window directly into my eyes, I can see that. And then, you know, at night, if, you know, I'm in a totally dark pitch black room, I know that, but that's about it. So I was very, very lucky in the fact that, again, I had some teachers, again, probably inspires me to do what I'm doing now, teaching, who really took me aside at a very young age and taught me how to read literary Braille. Braille is a 6-dot system. If you basically think about a rectangle, on the left, you have vertically stacked dots 1, 2, and 3. And on the right, we have 4, 5, and 6. And the combination of those dots make up everything, no matter if you're reading print or if you're reading music or if you're doing math or you're trying to learn how to read another language. It's all the same, all the six, the same 6 dots. So it's very contextual. And you have to almost kind of like do like some code switching. At first, I didn't have any access to music when I was, you know, very, very young, like in elementary school, you know, just because a lot of people didn't know about it. And then in middle school, they have what's called teachers of the visually impaired, and they're responsible for basically making sure that I had the materials I needed to be what's called mainstream, meaning I was the only disabled, you know, student in the class with everyone else, and basically be able to, you know, do everything that my sighted peers would do. And just so happens that my vision teacher, when I was starting band, luckily enough, was a music major at Florida State University, and then decided to become a vision instructor. So she, along with my mother, said, there's got to be a way that, you know, that Matt can do this. There's got to be, you know, a system of Braille that we just don't know about. And we did some research between my mom, this vision instructor, and myself, and figured out, yes, there is Braille music. At that time, because this was a while ago, not to date myself, but there wasn't a lot of access to it. Basically, if you wanted a saxophone part, because they're not, you know, super distributed, meaning that, you know, you might play a piece that's never been played before, especially at like the high school and more professional levels. So that piece maybe not existed before. So unless you're trying to play like, say, Beethoven's Fifth or Moonlight Sonata, these are very famous musical pieces. By like Mozart or Beethoven. it's very difficult to get the music because it hasn't been produced yet in Braille. So you have to send it off. And at that point, you basically, it had to be what they call a certified transcriber, meaning someone that prepares Braille materials for the state or for the county on some academic level and had to be certified. And there was basically probably maybe 9 or 10, maybe 20 for the entire nation. So you got to figure, you know, multiply that times every county, every city in the U.S., and you have a lot of, you know, demand for it. So it would take anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks, if you're lucky, to get a piece of Braille music. So, of course, that does not work for someone like myself, because 6 or 8 weeks passes in a band room, we're talking probably the concert and we're not even playing the music anymore. So basically, my mother decided, God bless her soul, that she would, you know, along with this vision instructor, because you get a new vision instructor about every couple of years, actually, almost sometimes every grade level, but at least, you know, every couple of grade levels. So we knew that the current vision instructor was not going to be my teacher for that long. So my mom took it upon herself to kind of help me learn how to Braille the music. And it's a good thing because when I got to college, I've had to relearn Braille music a couple of times because they now have a pretty unified code throughout the world. But at that point, we, you know, a lot of the cymbals and stuff, I was playing jazz music. Jazz is kind of a more flexible sort of music. If you're playing a band piece, you have to really make sure you know all the notes on the page. With jazz, you know, there's some improvisation involved, and some of the jazz pieces are even that are really old from like the 30s and 40s that literally have like hand scribbled notes on them. So we had to almost come up with our own set of like Braille notation. You know, the quarter notes, the eighth notes, these are note values, basically saying how long you play a note or a pitch in music were the same. But a lot of the symbols telling you how loud or how soft, how intensely or, you know, how smoothly, we had to come up with all of those symbols by ourselves. And then as time went along, there's been some technology. There's a company called Dancing Dots out in Philadelphia that's done some work. You can scan a piece of music, but it's still not perfect. So they still have to have some editing and someone who's sighted to kind of help you a little bit. But yeah, my mother basically, you know, brailled all my music and still brails a lot of my music today, just because sometimes the day of, especially when you're talking about improvisation and the students that are coming to class, you know, sometimes I'll find out, oh, I need this piece, but I didn't know I needed it today. And so you have to be able to kind of just on the fly of, you know, seat of your pants, okay, try to produce this, and you can't really wait around for others. So it's gotten much, much better. But when I got to college, actually, we were still even then, the technology didn't really exist, and there weren't still as many transcribers. There were more, kind of went from like 8 weeks to maybe 4 weeks, but still just not enough time. So my mom and I had to basically produce all of the textbooks. When you go to college and you graduate high school, there's an organization usually of some type that will assist you as somebody who's visually impaired. In Florida, it's called the Division of Blind Services, but they really are just there to kind of assist you to figure out what you need to do to be successful. You have to kind of be your own advocate, and that's really where some of my public speaking journeys began, because I had to take basically the professors aside every semester and say, this is what I need, and I'm going to need it, you know, at least a month in advance.
Wow.
And try to prove to them, you know, say, listen, I know you don't believe it right now, but give me 4 weeks and I'm going to be one of the best students in your class, and I'm going to work twice as hard as everyone else, and I'm going to prove to you that this is going to be worth your while to, you know, it's a little bit more work for you, but it's a lot more work for me, you know, and I'm, you know, having to do a lot of this work myself. And it, you know, we had to be very inventive when it came time to like some of the standardized testing and stuff, because at that time, again, they didn't have really, you know, you could send it off, but you might not get that test for another month, you know, and that just didn't work. So we had to, like, you know, sometimes figure out a way so that like I wouldn't see the test until, you know, seconds before I got it, you know, it was sent to me. So just a lot of inventive, a lot of thinking outside of the box, really, really kind of thinking on the fly and kind of figuring out, you know, I always say turn your disadvantage into an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
So I say, like, well, I can't read music really, really well because I got kind of a late start, but you know, I have good ears and I have a good sense of time and some things that a lot of my peers maybe don't have, because maybe they spent too much time trying to read the music. And so kind of combine all those talents. And I've really done my best. My kind of journey in life and teaching, my purpose And I have taught both blind and sighted students. I currently have two visually impaired students in another organization I work with outside of the conservatory. But my purpose is, if I could change the life of another Matt Weimuller, if I can say, this is what you got to do so you don't have to go through all of these challenges and navigate things differently. If you can have, not have to work four times as hard, only maybe two times as hard as someone else, then I've done my job, then I've made a difference. Mm. And that's really what my kind of goal in life is,
Where'd you get that from? I mean, were you like this as a young child? Like, I don't care if I can't see, I'm going to take this and I'm going to run with it.
Yes. Well, I blame and credit my mother and my dad and my family. They're both very driven. My mother was a stockbroker. My father has been a very successful attorney, and they didn't always have everything growing up, and they kind of just had that mentality, that type A, gotta go get it. And because of that, I was very competitive, and I had some friends early on who had some disabled siblings actually that really also motivated me. And I didn't start out like this, of course, but I've always just been very driven. It's always just like, what do I kind of need to do to be as successful as my friends, and sometimes better? I want to beat them at something. I've always been very competitive. I was really into sports as a young child.
Really?
Yes. My father is a huge sports enthusiast, and he actually still coaches this day. It's called Challenger Little League. It's basically like a baseball. It's kind of like Sandlot. If you ever seen Sandlot,
yes.
Everybody bats. We don't keep track of outs. Most of the players are physically handicapped, and a lot of them are mentally, on the spectrum in some way. And I did that until I was about 10 or 12, so I started playing saxophone. And so I think kind of that competitive nature, from sports and from my friends just being, kind of challenging me. I've just always wanted to be the best, and it took some time, obviously, for me to figure out, okay, what does that mean? But, I heard one time, it's not how hard you fall, but it's the getting back up that really matters. Mm-hmm. And I think, they say, every failure is better than a success.
Yes.
And I think that's really been true for me, because I have gone through, let me tell you, when I was very young, it took a while to figure out, oh, this is what you got to do, to tell the teacher, because, you do have people in general, the teachers are already, it's very difficult to be a teacher, I'll tell you, just from my own experience. And they already have a lot on their plate. And lots of times that sometimes they're, maybe overworked, underpaid, depending upon the situation. And they're trying to do their best. And then you bring, this child into the room and say, I need you to work five times harder, because what you're doing right now isn't good enough. Mm. And it took a while to figure that out. It wasn't like it happened overnight. But between my mom and my dad both taught me at a young age, and I kind of just figured it out from some of the failures and some of the things that just didn't work in the classroom, that I was going to need to be my advocate from a pretty early time of life. I can remember being in, like, say, 9th or 10th grade, and a lot of people think, and there's even this argument in music, and I give lectures about this. I currently have a webinar all about it. They see, a visually impaired child or a blind student, especially in music, and they say, oh, we know how to get around to learning how to read music. You're going to do everything by ear. And I go to these band directors every year. I at least have one person call me. It never fails. And they say, yeah, I've done so well. I've been teaching this kid. He has perfect pitch. Perfect pitch is basically you can hear a note, like even a car horn. And you can say, oh, that's a C, that's a C chord, or that's a C or a D. And a lot of visually impaired students have this ability, but I say to them, well, why don't you teach all the other students? Why don't the side students just do it that way? And they're like, oh, I didn't think about that. And it was the same way in grade school and in high school. I had a teacher, an English teacher one time. She didn't get the tests in time to my vision instructor, so it didn't get brailled. And her excuse was, well, I'm just going to give it to you verbally. And she gave it to me verbally, and I failed the test. And from that day forward, I said, no. Just like everybody else, we have visual learners, we have kinetic learners, we have auditory learners. Your job as a teacher is to figure out what I am. And I am a visual learner. Even though I'm blind, I have to be able to see the Braille. Mm. And I advocate for Braille. There's a thing called the Braille Challenge that I'm a part of every year that my high school vision instructor runs. And I, stand up and talk and tell the kids, this is what you got to do. It's because Braille is hard, especially. A lot of people are not born without sight. A lot of them lose their sight later on. And I'm here to tell you that trying to learn how to read Braille, if you're in your teens or even your 20s or 30s or 40s, it's very, very difficult. You know, you have to have this sensitivity with your fingertips. I that's how I read, is with mostly my index fingers, but all the other five fingers of my hand. From a very early time, I kind of developed like a tactile sensitivity. And, you know, as you're older, you know, you get calluses on your fingers and your fingertips, and it can be very struggling. And it's easy to say, oh, I just, you know, figure out another way of doing this. But I try to really advocate, you know, for those people and say, well, this is what you got to do to be literate, really. You know, if you can't read Braille, you're not really literate. You can't really read as somebody who's visually impaired. And I've got a lot of pushback, and there's a lot of debate both in the visually impaired world and even the sighted world in terms of you know, how to teach, you know, students who are visually impaired. So that's kind of why I just really appreciate being able to have the time to speak to someone like yourself and have these opportunities to really try to educate the people, because there's those teachers that are out there, they don't know what you don't know. Mm. And so until someone comes along, a parent, a student, an advocate, there's not really a way for them to be educated, you know, without outlets like this, like this podcast. There's really no way to inform and tell people, this is my story. I, you know, had to go through all these challenges, and it was tough and it was hard, but I found ways to make, you know, a career out of it and to be successful. I believe at least a little bit. I'm not the best saxophonist in the world or the best educator. I'm sure I do plenty of things wrong. But again, like I said, I think it's enough that we can educate a teacher, a student, a parent, an advocate, so that they don't have to have maybe some of these same challenges and can maybe even be more successful than myself.
I love it.
Don't go anywhere. We'll have more of the Janice Dean podcast right after this.
Tell me about you talking to your students about turning out the lights when they're practicing or they're learning. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so it's kind of something I do, and it's really, I would really do it with any student, and I think any sighted person might try to do it too. I just have a little bit more of an advantage, especially in jazz. What I teach at the Patel Conservatory is a lot about how to solo and improvise. When you play in a jazz big band, like your, you know, standard high school, you might have, you know, one or two opportunities per year if you're one of the better, more advanced students to kind of be featured, and, you know, they call it soloing. And to do that, you have to basically know a little bit about kind of the building blocks of music. I tell my students that I'm kind of like an English teacher, and we're, you know, talking about all the parts. You know, like, what is a prepositional phrase? Well, that's what a dotted quarter note is in music. And kind of a advantage and disadvantage of some of that is that sometimes the students, they get buried in their music. They're so focused on how do I read what's on the sheet that it almost betrays them. They don't quite get the overall concept that I'm trying to teach them because they're looking at the page. Mm. I try to explain to them, when I was coming up, I didn't have the page. So like I said, it's a disadvantage, but it's an advantage, because for jazz improvisation, you really have to use your ear, and it's really about more of having kind of a musical conversation. So I turn the lights out, and basically there's no way then that anybody can see their music. And now they have to, you know, use those other skills. They have to listen to the piano player if they're a saxophone player. They have to listen to the saxophone player if they're accompanying on the piano or the bass with the drum set. And you know, it's funny, they ask me, how do you do this? And I say, well, welcome to every day of my life, you know, and kind of just put them kind of in that same, you know. And it's something I would do with anyone, because we're trying to have a musical conversation. And so I'm trying to eliminate those other variables, you know, like the sheet music, and really get them to really put themselves completely in the moment, completely, you know, in the music, and really to be listening and trying to communicate to each other. And, you know, by cutting off one of those senses, you know, you have to really try to use your ears, to use your sense of spatial orientation, where I am in the room, you know, so that if you get up and have to stand up and walk somewhere, you know, you don't run into somebody. And it's kind of like a group, you know, class interaction project, because, you know, that way they start, you know, some of the students that maybe didn't want to talk to each other, now they have to, because it's the only way to do it. So it really serves a number of purposes. And I think it's, you know, it's very helpful and beneficial. And, you know, like I said, I kind of laugh at them and say, well, now you know how I feel every day. you know, this is what you got to do. Because again, like I said, you know, I have a hard time if, you know, maybe, you know, I have to memorize all my music, I tell the students, because I don't have three hands. I read the music first and then memorize it and then listen to it. You know, that's kind of how when I was coming up again, I didn't have a lot of access to Braille music early on. So what I'd have to do is I'd have to get like my saxophone teacher, or find some recording of my part, listen to it, try to learn it, try to memorize it. And then I will get to Braille usually a week or two later, produced, you know, because my mom and I were trying to, you know, work on it. And then I would check the Braille for like any errors. So again, by turning off the lights, you know, I say, okay, let's try to rehearse the music, listen to it. You know, what do you notice? So that when we turn the lights back on, now you have a new perspective of what the music is really going to sound like and what you need to do to learn your part.
Hmm. And I feel you retain the information more. You know, I've always said I love this medium of podcasting because you don't have the distraction of what I look like, what's on the television screen. You have to listen. And
right,
I think just retaining information, getting information that way, I just think it's a better form of communication.
Right, definitely is. And it's kind of funny because I think in some ways being blind has helped me because I'm constantly in that world.
Hmm.
By the way, I'm sure you look great. you know, and I always joke with people. Yeah, during the pandemic, I attended a wedding via Zoom. And one of my friends, who's a saxophone player, you know, he said to the guy who's getting married, a bass player, "Oh, you're looking great." And I said, "Oh, you're looking great too." And it was funny because the husband of the guy that I was talking to, you know, he didn't get the, you know, he didn't get the joke. And the guy said, "Well, Matt's blind. He can't see." So, you know, and it's funny. We have, I won't go into it too much, but I am also in the world of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Mm-hmm. And, I think sometimes they call it like kind of unconscious bias. You know, you see something or somebody and you have an automatic impression of how they are. And
yes.
I think sometimes being visually impaired and blind and not being able to see someone, sometimes some of those biases I've been able to kind of not have and kind of get around a little bit better than maybe somebody, you know, also in my, you know, position growing up.
Yes.
And helped me to make friends. You know, I've always tried to be very independent. And one of the hardest things for me growing up was when and when not to ask for help.
Mm.
And a social aspect of it became, okay, when I do really need help, it's okay to ask for help sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a thing that a lot of visually impaired people do struggle with because just unfortunately, because of the situation, you are going to be in a place, a time where you're going to need to reach out to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why communication is so important, because if you can't communicate in some way, shape, or fashion, then you're not going to be able to ask for help and you're going to be in a lot of trouble and not as successful, you know, to others.
Mm,
so, you know, I just think communication is a very big skill.
It's a good lesson. So you and I were supposed to speak a couple of weeks ago, and something happened, something very significant, that you don't mind talking about. Can you tell me, you know, what you've gone through in the last couple of weeks? Really, it's a miraculous thing that you're here today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. So I was doing some traveling and got what I really thought was just kind of the flu, and tried to, you know, kind of do sleep and feel better, and it did not work. And I was unfortunately found unresponsive by my family. They couldn't wake me up. They called the ambulance, and I coded, meaning I flatlined 4 times on the way to the hospital. I went into cardiac arrest. It took 6 minutes to revive me. And then I was placed on dialysis and a ventilator for 8 days. It took them a lot. I wasn't responding to the treatments. They originally told my family to prepare for the worst, that most people who are in cardiac arrest for that long will not wake up. And if they do wake up, they'll have severe brain damage and will not be able to talk or walk or do most of the, you know, regular functions of a human being. They brought in the priest after about 2 days to pray, and told the family to go get my sister, bring her, get the family together and prepare to possibly say goodbye, because I was not responding. And the odds of me really, you know, being able to talk or walk again and just really have any type of quality of life was very, very minimal. And, you know, they were kind of getting ready to pull the plug, so to speak. And like I said, I'm a fighter, and I always try to turn my disadvantages into advantages. So that's what I did. And luckily within 4 days, they were able to get a treatment that got me off of dialysis. I'm still dealing with it a little bit. And then 4 days after that, on the eighth day, I magically woke up, and they don't really know exactly why. They diagnosed me as having, you know, basically several upper respiratory, you know, infections, having pneumonia, RSV, and having MRSA, which is pretty serious. And after I woke up, it was great. 2-3 days later, I was doing physical therapy to try to walk. They had to tie me down to the ventilator because I'm very tactile sensitive, as I was talking about earlier. And apparently I didn't like them putting stuff on my hands and face. Mm. So even though I was not awake, I still kind of tried to fight them. So they had to, you know, kind of, you know, try to make sure I could move around. And because of that non-movement for 8 days, you're not supposed to lay in bed straight for 8 days, I guess. Not a healthy, I guess, recommended, you know, I like to sleep, but maybe not that much. Mm-hmm. And, so they found a blood clot in my leg, a very deep blood clot. And I had to get kind of a more experimental surgery to get the blood clot out. They did. It was kind of funny because I felt like I was kind of in the Matrix. They had these people with computers, kind of like almost, they acted like they're playing video games, and we got 90% of the clot, and, you know, we're very excited and trying to help do this more experimental surgery. And they got almost all of the clot out, which was really amazing. I'm told that's usually not the case. I was placed on blood thinners. I spent about, you know, a few more weeks in the hospital, and, you know, finally was able to be upgraded, and really through the miracle and health care of just several really amazing nurses and doctors. I was at St. Joseph's Hospital North, if I can give a shout out, just some really amazing people. They got me, you know, better. And it was just funny because, like, the last week anyways, I was in the hospital, I had at least 4 or 5 nurses who, you know, had done their rotations a few weeks before, and they were coming back. One of them came back from vacation, and she said, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe you're up and you're sitting up and you're talking and you sound great." Wow. She said, I don't know if you know, Matthew, but you were going to die. You know, my dad, you know, when I talked to your dad, and he didn't think you were going to wake up, and you just don't know how lucky you are. And it's funny, while I was, I guess, in a coma, so to speak, on the ventilator, my family brought a stereo in and played jazz music for me every day. And when I woke up, it was funny, I had this melody stuck in my head, and I get recordings, like, you know, jazz recordings for Christmas every year. And I went through all my recordings while I was like, because I wasn't really doing a lot of stuff just other than trying to be better. So I was listening to all these recordings, trying to find this melody. And it turns out it was on the TV, the nurses, because, you know, they listened to the same records about 100 times. They were like, "Well, there's this channel on the TV that plays jazz. Let's listen to that for a minute." And it turned out to be one of those songs. And somehow I don't know if I can credit it or not, but I can tell you that it's a melody that's stuck in my head, and really probably listening to that music, I kind of credit to maybe magically waking up. Cause again, they really can't completely explain what happened. You know, they said that somebody in my condition shouldn't have gone down like that. And there's just no way. Like, I mean, we're talking like in the 5th percentile of people that wake up from something that severe and traumatic, and, you know, aren't severely brain damaged and don't have, you know, some of the struggle. So I'm doing much better now. I'm happy to say, through the care of the nurses and the doctors, but a very, very challenging time. I'm still having some issues walking because of the clot, and just because my body was shut down for an entire week. But I you know, I've been talking to my students because, you know, now that I've been able to get back a little bit to teaching and playing, that was, you know, that was like my biggest fear, when I was rehabbing and trying to get better. My mom and dad brought my saxophone into the hospital, and I got to play, and it was the happiest moment, I think, of my life that I can remember. It was like, oh, I can play saxophone. Cause the biggest thing that scared me when I woke up was like, oh, I don't think I'm ever going to play saxophone again. You know, my hands shook really bad because again, they had to tie me down to the ventilator. So like I couldn't hold anything in my left hand when I first woke up. And, you know, so it's like, well, even holding the saxophone, you know, and I, you know, I, my lung, you know, I'm told, you know, I had these upper respiratory infections and issues, you know, how is this going to affect my lung capacity? And so I can just say for anybody that's listening to this, you know, we talk, music therapy is a very big and upcoming industry. And I'm here to tell you that when you go through something like I did, when you're in cardiac arrest for 6 minutes, it's going to change your life. You're never going to be the same person. And I'm not the exact same person I was when I went to the hospital, but music has really helped to heal me and, you know, helped me to at least be getting back, you know, where I'm able to do a lot of the things that I, you know, couldn't do while I was recovering, and has really been an inspiration to me, you know, just getting back to being able to teach my students. I told my students, I have a couple of students that are dealing with some things that I can't go into, obviously, but I, you know, took them aside the first day I was back and said, listen, I'm going to tell you what happened to me, because I want to make sure you know that, you know, if I'm not dead, I'm going to be here teaching you, you know, and the reason I wasn't here was because I almost died, you know, and music means that too much to me. And it may have been the reason I woke up and recovered, you know, who really knows? I know that the melody is stuck in my head and I'm going to write songs about it. And it's, you know, music was definitely integral in my recovery and making me feel better and inspiring me to get better quickly and to work that much harder in my recovery, to be able to walk and be able to hold things and do all the normal activities that, you know, people do every day. And so it's just been, it's been a journey. And I really appreciate you letting me talk. I can tell you it's just very therapeutic. Just talking about it right now has been really great.
Well, no, I'm grateful you are telling that story, because it might help somebody else. And you talk about music helping your life. I really believe now more than ever, we really need things that will bring us together. And I think music is one of those things. You know, you can go to a concert or you listen to a song on the radio. And I just think, you know, the way the world is right now, there's so much division, but something like music can really bond us in a way that's kind of not describable sometimes. So I'm just so appreciative of you. I love your story. Your students are so fortunate to have you. You know, what's next for you? What do you want to do? Uh-huh. What do you want to accomplish?
Well, I'm hoping to just expand things further and to teach inspire. Spread the story more and more as I can. I'm trying to grow the jazz program every year at the Stras Center. We do a summer camp that's at the end of June every year. We are having auditions in May for that, and hoping to try to be able to bring. I do these virtual video performances with students with disabilities, and just kind of hoping to continue to grow my teaching career. I would like to eventually expand. I've taught students at the university level, but I haven't quite had the opportunity to be a university professor. So that's a goal that I'm still working towards and talking to some individuals. And I'm hoping to be able to share some of my own music. I have several recordings that are not quite of quality that I want to release to the public yet, but I'm hoping to work on them. And I keep telling everyone I'm going to release the album, you know, and try to share, you know, definitely this experience being in the hospital, I think is going to kind of speed that up, hopefully. So hopefully you'll get to hear the music of Matt Weimuller soon. And like I said, you know, just being able to keep playing and growing as a teacher and trying to inspire students and, you know, meeting new people on, you know, a city, county, state, national, and maybe even an international level, you know, hopefully soon, as I've had a little bit of opportunity to do that, but would just like to continue, like I said, to grow my jazz program at the Patel Conservatory. I teach mostly students in high school, but I've taught students as young as 10 and students as old as 60. So we have several programs over there. So I'd love, you know, for people to come and check out, you know, what I do. And, you know, if you see me on the road, you know, just say, hey. And, you know, the more people that I can talk to and share my story with, I think the more I can improve the lives of others.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm so happy to share your story. And I'm sure you've touched people just by listening to your, you know, voice and what you've been through. It really is inspiring. I think I mentioned that at the beginning of the interview. How can people find you, Matt?
I'm on social media, on LinkedIn and Facebook by just my name, Matthew Weimuller. And I'm currently, it's down right this second, but I'm working on my websites. If you go to, you know, MatthewWeimuller.com or BlindSaxophonist.com or SaxLessonsForTheVisuallyImpaired.com, pretty soon they'll all be linked up. And I'm hoping to, that's kind of another one of my goals to to make myself a little bit more present, you know, socially on the web. And if you just come to the Stras Center, I do lots of stuff there. We're going to be having a student performance in May. I believe it's May 11th, but don't quote me on that. It's a Saturday. We always have the performances on the weekends. I play all around Tampa, a lot in the downtown area. And if I can, may I share my contact information?
Sure.
Would that be inappropriate?
No, I don't think so.
I can be my email address is saxmatt7, so it's like saxophone, SAXMATT, my name 7 at gmail.com. So saxmatt7 at gmail.com. And that's probably, you know, if you just want to email me at that address, I check it very, very often. And should get back to you within a day and hope to hear from some of you. So again, that's saxmatt7 at gmail.com.
I love it. I know you're going to hear from a lot of people just to say thank you, because
thanks.
I thank you for being here today, Matt. And let's be in touch, okay? Whenever you have that new music out, let me know, okay? And I'll make sure to give it a shout out.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Thanks again to my guest, Matt Weimuller, for spending time with us today. I hope you enjoyed hearing our conversation as much as I enjoyed talking with him. I appreciate his openness and honesty, especially when it comes to challenges, because I think when we talk about the tough stuff that's going on in our lives, it's a chance to connect with others and make them feel like they are not alone. Matt hopes he can be a force for good in terms of being a music teacher and a good human. It was a pleasure chatting with him, and I hope I can meet him in person someday as well. If you would like to learn more about Matt or the conservatory where he teaches, you can head to www.strascenter.org/patel-conservatory. Thank you to all of my listeners. If you have someone you think should make the Dean's List, let me know at Janice Dean on Twitter or Janice Dean FNC on Instagram. Or you can rate this podcast. Please subscribe, rate, and review to this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or at foxnewspodcast.com. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.